I'm Hugo MacDonald, and welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's weekly design show. Hello and welcome to Section D, Monocle 24's weekly design show. I'm Hugo MacDonald, Monocle's design editor. Coming up on today's show, we take a trip to Finland's oldest company, the scissors manufacturer Fiskars.
Once you look at the scissor, it looks like a simple product, but then going into details, it's not a product where you actually combine two knives, it's more than that.
We head to New York architect Deborah Burke's home to learn about a few of her favourite things.
Well, the Polaroid is among my truly most favorite thing. I use it to document dinner parties.
We also take a look at the built environment in our hometown of London with the Architecture Foundation director, Sarah Ichioka.
London, like so many great cities, grew up around this amazing body of water, the Thames River, which we can see right from our rooftop and our front door.
All that and much, much more coming up on Section D. But first, the design news with Gillian DeBias.
Ulico CEO Tadashi Yani said the firm remains on target to be the largest clothing retailer on Earth by 2020. Last Friday, he unveiled the biggest Uniqlo flagship in the world, an 89,000 square foot unit on New York's Fifth Avenue. Designed by Japanese firm Wonderwall, it's a bold statement of expansion in an otherwise failing high street retail market. By 2020, Yani said Uniqlo would have 4,000 stores worldwide. The UN's Education and Culture Agency has warned the Spanish city of Seville that it may lose its status as a UN World Heritage Site because of a new 41-story skyscraper under construction near the historic city center. Renowned for its charming streets and 16th-century Gothic cathedral, the skyscraper would mar the cityscape. Due to complete next year, it was designed by Argentine-American architect Cesar Pelli and will house the offices of Spanish savings banks Cajasol. Pelli is no stranger to making his mark on cityscapes. He was the architect responsible for the Petronas Towers in Kuala Lumpur. The Nordic region's largest infrastructure project is taking shape at the consultancy firm Ramboll in Copenhagen. It will be the world's longest tunnel at 18 kilometres, connecting the Fehmarn Belt between Rødby in Denmark and Puttgarden in Germany. It's expected to be finished by 2020. The tunnel will employ approximately 6,000 people during peak construction period and is about three times as long as the BART tunnel in San Francisco, the longest tunnel in the world. It will cut travelling time between Copenhagen and Hamburg from 4.5 hours to just 3. On Friday, the V&A announced plans for its big show next year, which will showcase more than 7 decades of the best of British design. From the Hacienda Club to Concord and the E-Type Jaguar to the miniskirt, the ambitious show will include fashion, art, graphics, industrial design, craft and architecture. Curated by Christopher Breward and Ghislaine Wood, the collection is an assessment of all that Britain has produced since it last held the Olympics in 1948. And finally, one of the stranger stories to come in this week revealed that Pope Benedict XVI sat on a specially customized scape chair by Antonio Citterio for Swiss manufacturer Vitra. The chair, designed for office use, was given a holy makeover for its special guest, upholstered in white leather and adorned with an embroidered papal emblem. It remains to be seen whether sales of the scape have skyrocketed in Catholic countries around the world.
Thank you, Gillian, and welcome to the first edition of Section D. Section D is our weekly show covering design, architecture, fashion, graphics and retail, all disciplines we collectively refer to as design here at Monocle. It's not a show about chairs and tables, though it's likely we may hear about a few of these from time to time. It's a show about the things we live with, celebrating the things that make life that little bit better, and telling the stories of how they came into being, and the stories of the people behind them. Each week, I'll be joined in the studio by the very finest characters in the industry, and I'm delighted to kick things off with one of my very favourite people, Ilse Crawford. At just 23, Ilse was the launch editor of Elle Decoration. She now runs her own pioneering brand identity company, Studio Ilse, spreading her cool head, warm heart approach to everything from hotels to restaurants, shops, furniture and lighting. And when she's not making the world a better place herself, she's teaching others to, as head of the Man and Wellbeing Department at Design Academy Eindhoven. Welcome, Ilse. I wanted to kick things off by asking you to bring something in with you that sort of illustrates a little bit about your feelings and thoughts on design. And I can see that you've got something on the other side of the table there.
Well, difficult task to select something, but in the end it had to be portable. But also, given, I think, the subjects that we're going to touch on later on, I chose some glasses by a heroine of mine, Inga Gudrunen, a Swedish industrial designer. And they're remarkable because they embody, I think, a lot of what the issues in design are today. So they're made in an old-fashioned way by Skruf, but they're simply designed. Because they're made in an old-fashioned way, they're rather expensive. But they're beautiful, they're functional, they're strong and last a very long time. But more important than any of that, when you use them, they are completely poetic. They lift that activity, whatever it is, drinking water, to another level. It makes you aware of the quality of what you're doing. And I think that value is something that the traditional ways of making things can bring. And I think it shows how really there is a value in keeping those older traditions, that they do have relevance today.
That leads us very nicely into our first package, Ilse. Last week, I visited Finland's oldest company, Fiskars. You might not know them by name, but you'll definitely know what they make. Orange-handled kitchen scissors.
You probably already know that we are now, not physically, but as a company, we are in the oldest company of Finland. And apparently also in the whole of Scandinavia, even though we can't really track it. Fiskars was established in 1649 in the same surroundings, doing ironworks, and we have been doing it ever since. I think the turnover is currently something like 700 something million for the whole corporation, and we operate globally. We have our own offices in certain countries, and then we do a lot of export. We divide our business into three areas, which is home, garden and outdoors.
The factory is in a small town called Billnäs. It's hard to believe, pulling up to the doors, that each of the Fiskars scissors in global circulation has such an unassuming birthplace. But it's so very Finnish, too. Something the Finns do so well is meticulous, everyday design. And something they understand better than most is the importance of keeping manufacturing on home turf. It's a way of safeguarding the core of the brand. Each pair of scissors is stamped with Stainless Finland on them. And touring the factory with the head of scissors product development, Heikki Saivalainen, it's clear this company would lose its soul if manufacturing would be outsourced.
It's quite nice that the people who work here, they are pretty much from this area, from Tammisaari or Karja but pretty much from this area. And it's funny to discuss with people here, because if you discuss with a lady who is 60, she can tell you that, okay, my daughter is also working. But it's like several generations have been working on the same factory. And it's nice to discuss with people. My mom used to work there. My mom used to do that product and so on.
So it's a very strong part of the community in the local area.
Yeah.
And do you train people in the factory all the different things?
Yes. And I think something that we do here is something special, and we want to keep it inside. And not, of course, the people have different backgrounds, and we appreciate that a lot. But then on top of it, we want to teach them the Fiskars certain processes that we do here only inside.
These company community towns are scarce in Europe, and it's not just a nostalgic notion that local manufacturing is good. Companies such as Fiskars are the beating heart of the local community, socially and economically.
So the idea is that in that corner, there's the incoming material. All the raw materials are coming in that corner, and then there's blanking, and then there's heat treatment, then there's grinding, and then there's still some grinding and blade marking, and then final assembly and injection molding and inspection. So then you get the best picture from what's happening here.
everything happens in this one room.
In these two rooms?
Yeah.
Have you been to a Caesar's factory before?
No, never.
No.
It's the first time for everything.
Yeah. There's not so many Caesar's factories in Europe anymore. Production is pretty much in Far East nowadays.
But it still makes sense for Fiskars to manufacture in Finland.
Yeah, it makes sense. I think it makes sense because we are keeping the product alive and have something special compared to the Far East products.
And it's such a Finnish brand as well.
It makes sense. It really makes sense. And it would be a shame that it would change over to outsource production.
As Finland's oldest company, Fiskars has a long history, and one its employees wear with pride. In the mid-19th century, the Fiskars plough was the first product to be patented in Finland. In the mid-1960s, Fiskars was one of the first European companies to make microwaves. But it's the scissors that are the brand's calling card.
First, this is a pair of scissors from late 19th century. And actually, when you take the newest orange-handled scissors, these two are quite alike. They have the same ergonomic handle shapes. Once you look at the scissor, it looks like, as Siru said, it looks like really simple product, but then going into details, it's not a product where you actually combine two knives. It's more than that. What makes it so different is that in the late 19th century, the pair of scissors like this cost like a month's salary for a tailor. But then in 1967, when the orange-handled scissors was launched, the price for normal consumer was only like 1 hour's salary, so everybody can actually afford that pair of scissors at that time. So that was very big.
Far from resting on their laurels, the Fiskars development team constantly seeks ways to improve their scissors. Even the simplest things can be made better is their motto. Fiskars estimates that it has sold over 1 billion pairs of scissors. It's a local manufacturing success story. But the company has another string to its bow. Such was the success of the scissors in the late 1960s, the company was forced to build a new factory. In 1973, it moved operations from Fiskars Village to its current location at Billnäs, a few kilometres away. So what happened to the original site? We left the Billnäs factory and headed back to Fiskars Village to see what was going on there.
Oh, this is the old headquarters of Fiskars. It's being renovated now, so unfortunately you don't see it, but it's a beautiful old mansion.
Does it have quite a strong tourist attraction?
Yes,
for
it is.
Finnish people?
It is.
And does Fiskars, the company, put money back into the local community?
We support them in that sense that we own all the... Lena knows best on this around here, but for example, in Fiskars Village, we own a great deal on the land and the forest. And we have, for example, I just heard that we are hired two hunters and a dog. Is paid by Fiskars, so that we take care of the forest and the wildlife surroundings as well, and then you know bring some of the material back to the community. And also we rent out, apparently in a fairly reasonable price, the buildings for the artists. So okay. I think this is, and of course you know Fiskars is the biggest employer in this area as a big factory, so it's also a very important element for the city. I really like this surroundings. It's just really beautiful and somehow very harmonic.
When operations were moved to Billnäs, the original factory buildings and homes at Fiskars Village were emptied. But the company, which owned all the surrounding land and buildings, spotted an opportunity. In 1987, the deputy CEO, Ingmar Lindberg, started the New Life for the Ironworks project and invited craftsmen and artists from all over Finland to occupy the former Fiskars Village buildings for low rent. This breathed new life into the area and fostered a community with creativity at its core. Fiskars Village Lena Venjo explains more.
The company still owns here some 11,000 hectares land in and around this village. So what we have today, we have the real estate operations here that we manage the village and the land here and also the factories. What we do, we rent workshops, mainly workshops and shops, and get rental income. Of course, we invest in the village quite much because we own most of the buildings here in the center of the city and the land. In 1994, there were about 20 artists and designers living in the village, and they came up with the idea about an exhibition, and they wanted to show craft and art side by side, which was a new idea in those days. And the exhibition was very well received, many visitors, so they decided to do it next year. And today there's a cooperative of artists and designers living in village, and in order to be a member in that, you have to work or live here, and most of them do both things. So the cooperative has 120 members, and if you think that most of them live here with their families, there's all around some 600 inhabitants in the village. So it's a very big part of the community.
There's now a smithy, a ceramics kiln, a paper factory, a candle factory, a carpentry, a silver and a gold works in Fiskars village. And the success is far from local. One of the first to move to Fiskars in the late 1980s was carpenter Kari Virtanen, attracted not just by the low rent and fairy tale surroundings, but also by the 29 different species of tree. Virtanen's brand, Nikari, though still something of an insider's secret, has recently set up operations in Japan and has furnished homes, schools and even Nobu restaurants. Despite Fiskars' global success, it's a company that understands the importance of keeping things local in terms of manufacturing and support for smaller enterprises in the surrounding community. It's a model many might think is old-fashioned or unsustainable, but with a net sales increase last year of 8%, it's one other manufacturers would do so well to follow. Joining Ilse and me in the studio, we also have Corinne Meller. Corinne is creative director of David Meller Design, the heritage British tableware company founded by his father. Corinne graduated in product design from Kingston and worked for London architects YRM before joining his father. As well as overseeing special product development at David Meller Design, he has also worked on a number of special commissions in the UK. Welcome, Corinne.
Thank you very much for inviting me. It's a pleasure.
No, I'm thrilled, actually, because we were having a small chat before and you said that you'd been to Fiskars.
It must have been 10 years ago.
Oh, gosh.
Yeah.
So that was around the time when the community was still being set up, I guess.
It was actually set up and running. Whether it was to the same extent as what you've recently seen, I'm not sure, but it was certainly on the way.
It's quite a remarkable thing to go and see what would have been empty historic buildings filled with a number of people all working together and selling their things and doing it with such success. I mean, I feel like it's a model that could be rolled out everywhere.
Well, I was rather sort of blown over by the whole thing. And I have to say, I sort of returned to Derbyshire and sort of perhaps attempted to do a similar thing, but on a tiny scale. I was that impressed with the sort of the concept. And I suppose what I liked the idea of doing was actually having the manufacturing and the sort of the visitor's centre all on one site, which if you're actually only making a handful of knives and forks, you can get away with. Perhaps scissors is a bit harder.
You opened the visitor centre in 2005, was it?
Yeah.
And how is it going?
It's going incredibly well. I mean, I think people really do actually want to see things being made. And I also think people are sort of passionate about finding about how things have arrived and how things have designed as well as being made. And if you can sort of combine that into one, I hope that people sort of leave with a bit of a sort of sense of fulfilment in some way.
Absolutely, and I think today more than ever it's so important to put the story of your brand and how things are made and provenance, and I mean really any brand with a story worth telling tells it,
and not in a nostalgic way, you know.
No, exactly.
Isn't about romantic reminiscence. I think people are genuinely fascinated by process.
Definitely.
Absolutely.
And particularly with everyday items like cutlery, scissors.
I think with everything. I have just been to see the OMA show at the Barbican, and they've done exactly that, but about an architecture office. Mm. And it's completely fascinating. It's got everything from the contents of the bin to some of the daily emails. It's completely fascinating.
Yeah.
We're nosy. Humans want to know what goes on in other people's lives. They want to know what's behind things. And I think it's been the big mistake of European manufacturing to hide. You know, in the end, that is what makes things special. It's what makes things have a value.
Exactly. And the sadness when everything is outsourced to China and the conditions that people work under there aren't stories that you necessarily want to tell. The companies that have kept their manufacturing local and have a history to talk about reaping the rewards.
And I think, you know, there are many companies, and I think of a few, but, you know, Waterford, for example, I think is one, where they had the most incredible skills and processes and for, you know, whatever reasons, decided to outsource a great deal of manufacturing. And, you know, you can understand it logically, price points, et cetera, but, you know, it ultimately resulted in the loss of 2,000 jobs. Mm. And that's devastating. Mm. And at the same time, I think people would have been really fascinated to know more about that process, and not in a sort of, you know, old hat, glass-blowing kind of way, but really seeing it as the process that it genuinely is, and, you know, the impact that it had on the world at the time and now and so on. It's very sad, I think, when everything is driven simply by the bottom line and very short-term. As much as it's a reality, it's only part of the story.
And I think that's particularly true with sort of larger companies as well.
Yeah. And
I think you can sort of almost get away with the sort of the Fiskars model on a smaller scale. And we see that sort of throughout the UK with sort of small craftsmen and places that you can actually visit and you can go and see the wood turner. But on a bigger scale, it's much harder. And it really doesn't happen at all.
No, one of the things that I loved about Fiskars factory was how human everything was, all the different processes. And the best bit was actually the product testing itself, where there was a mother and a daughter, and they would pick up each pair of scissors as it came off the production line and cut a piece of material and then listen to it. And if the scissors sounded right, then they would be accepted. But we were given a pair of scissors that had been rejected to listen to see if we could notice the difference, and you absolutely couldn't. This was a mother and a daughter with skills that can't be replaced. And
that is the problem, isn't it? That once you lose the skills, you make people redundant and it's outsourced, you really are throwing your fortunes to the wind. Because what happens if, as is happening in China, the rates go up and actually, you know, they're no longer
exactly
competitive? Because after all, we're not just talking about labour rates, we're also talking about shipping. You know, the cost of oil goes up, et cetera, et cetera. You're out of control of an awful lot of those factors. And let's say you then want to bring manufacturing back to base. The skills are then gone. On the whole, it tends to be companies that are still owned in some way, rather than simply driven by share price, that can take those longer-term decisions.
Absolutely.
I think another thing that's interesting about your orange scissors is... certainly 20 years ago, all you could buy was Fiskars orange scissors. Hmm. Now the marketplace is actually flooded with orange scissors, which don't say Fiskars on them. But if you'd actually been to the Fiskars village, you would certainly buy Fiskars scissors. And I think that that's why it's so important to actually educate people. You know, people are receptive. And it's obviously shown that with Fiskars actually still being able to manufacture viably, that... it works.
Successfully. And actually that goes on to something else I wanted to talk about, which is how good Fiskars is at telling its own story. And it's not just about the visitor centre or the village and all the different events that go on there, but actually they produce such beautiful collateral material as well that goes into all the elements of the history of the area and how it's changed, and also the process of the making of the scissors and all the company information. It's just...
communication is a huge part of not just design, but a product, isn't it? And I think it's
absolutely
not about marketing. It's about telling the essential story of the thing. And I think that's something that's sometimes forgotten, is how sometimes you don't need to change the product. You simply need to change the way that you talk about it to the world.
Absolutely. Mm. This is such a big part of your work as well, isn't it, Ilse? Helping people understand sort of really what they want to say and how to say it.
Absolutely. And I think, you know, a lot of the time, you need, obviously, to have that embedded in the thing. It shouldn't be something that you apply at the last minute. But when you've got a great story like Fisker's, then I think the most important thing is for you to get that message out so that people understand what they're buying. And it's funny, we had a moment on a project in Stockholm where we wanted to introduce a very beautiful old table into a restaurant. It's a 16th century table, and the restaurant was all about, you know, the sort of Swedish way of cooking. So it was an interesting thing to have a table that hundreds of meals would have been eaten from in the mix. And, you know, there was a sort of moment because the table was a bit wobbly and the cook, Mattias Dahlgren, was obviously slightly concerned his customers might be upset by that. But we said, look, give it a month, and what your waiter needs to say is just, look, you know, this table has had hundreds, thousands of meals eaten of it, and, you know, we feel it's a very special part of the restaurant. And now people want that table. They especially ask for it. So it's all about how you explain it.
Yeah, definitely. Corinne, you've brought something in for us to...
Yes, I have to admit, I haven't actually managed to actually bring the real thing in. So I've had to bring a picture. I decided to keep it in the family. And I brought my father's 1965 traffic light design. And I've brought that because I'm quite a believer in that sort of good design can stand the test of time. And I'm also sort of slightly anti fashion in terms of product design, and not completely. I think there's a place for it, but I do also think there's a place for design that is almost so good that you don't notice it. And these traffic lights you stop at every day in your car and swear at them, and it's the same traffic light that was designed back in 1965. So yeah, I brought the picture and not the traffic light, unfortunately.
No, I can understand why. I'm amazed. I didn't know until you brought that in that your father had designed those.
Yeah, in our design museum in Hathersage, we have one standing sort of in the middle, and people think we've put it there as a bit of a joke. And it's only actually when they actually read the caption that they actually realise that these items have been designed. I mean, England is full of things like that. And there's a recent exhibition at the Design Museum of Ken Granger's work. And, you know, there are loads of things that you see and you think, oh, gosh, yes, someone's actually designed the parking meter.
Exactly.
Yeah, things that define Englishness, you think, actually someone made them.
Someone made them, yeah, yeah.
Has your father got any other hidden gems that we don't know about?
Well, I suppose he obviously he's sort of rather famous knives and forks.
Of course.
There's sort of a couple of park benches that were made in their millions, which you sort of still see around in parks. And there's a rather famous, I call it the Festival of Britain litter bin. There's a sort of yellow litter bin. And so there's a bit of an archive of these sort of non-design things that are around.
I couldn't recommend a trip up to Derbyshire more enough to go and see them, to go and see the steelworks too. Just returning to the steelworks that you have up there, I mean, you presumably employ quite a lot of local people there too.
Well, we're very tiny. I mean, we've got this rather large name, but our sort of manufacturing is on a tiny scale. And it was very interesting, again, listening to the Fisker's real factory, in that the steel comes in. And we have this old round building designed by Michael Hopkins, and the steel comes in, and the steel gradually, as it goes round the circle, turns into cutlery. And the last person we have is the inspector, known as a wiper-upper in Sheffield, who actually inspects the forks and puts them in their boxes. So it's very similar.
And how many people do you employ then?
Well, we only have 12 people making cutlery, so we're tiny, absolutely tiny.
Gosh, and you would never outsource...
I say no. We've always outsourced, and it's something that I think my sort of policy is that if we can make it, we'll make it. Mm-hmm. Then we'll look locally. So we use a lot of Sheffield trades. We use silver platers in Sheffield, injection moulders in Barnsley, or we'll go wherever. And I don't think my main thing is the quality. I have to have the best quality. I can't buy something from Rotherham if it's rubbish. Mm-hmm. I would rather go to Japan and buy something superb. So that's my main thing. But yes, we do make knives and forks.
Yes, of course. And how, I mean, up in Derbyshire, it has a big history of manufacturing that is in decline?
Oh, completely in decline. I mean, in the 50s, there were more than 300 cutlery firms. I think now there are five or six. It's as small as that. But the ones that are left are doing the top designs and the top quality. And I think that's how you can survive in the UK making, is actually making the best. And people do appreciate the best. So that's how you can do it. And that's what's left, really.
Yeah,
but funny enough, you know, there are companies manufacturing in Britain. For example, Quadrat apparently makes a lot of its, a Danish company, makes a lot of its textiles in Britain, which is quite funny.
Yeah.
You know, we think that we've lost our manufacturing, but actually there are others
who've lost it. No, I mean,
spotted that we've got things to offer.
No, I mean, there's plenty to offer in this country. I mean, I think making things to a price is not really terribly viable unless you're making one thing that you can not have people and have robots making. Mm. What we're terribly good at is we're terribly good at designing things, and we're also terribly good at specials and high techs, and both of those two sort of specialist areas we excel at.
Mm. And not everything needs to be cheap. I mean, for sure, you know, Europe and Britain can't compete on that price thing. Although, actually, there are those who say that we're probably not quite as bad as we think we are in some areas. But the special, we can, and that's something that the world wants. I mean, the remarkable thing about Europe is that we have these abilities, this imagination, these design skills that are unique and special, and the rest of the world wants them.
Absolutely. Absolutely. And I think as well as there's also a huge tradition and sort of expanding craft field as well. And craftsmanship has always been incredibly strong in this country. And I do think that's something that, you know, we really do get a star for, is craftsmanship.
And I feel like there's a renewed interest in it as well.
Absolutely.
People who,
absolutely,
you know, are understanding the importance of keeping craft in people's hands nationally.
Mm. Well, and you can see increasingly that there's an international market for that. And that word luxury, whatever it means, and we won't get into it right now because you could go on forever.
Oh, why not?
But, you know, it also means special and rare. And I think that's something that we've got in Britain, you know, really quite big quantities, but we just need to support it.
Make sure that
absolutely.
We keep
and develop it.
No, absolutely.
And shout about it.
Yeah.
Thank you, Karin Meller, for joining us in the studio. You're listening to Section D on Monocle 24. Coming up next, we take a peek through the keyhole of New York architect Deborah Burke's home. But we'll be back in a moment.
From the end of October, you'll be able to download Monocle's first app, featuring our Monocle 24 radio player, daily monocolumn feed, and our global 2525 City Guide series. With its unique timeshift device to spool through programmes, you can either listen live or catch up on anything you might have missed via our archive. The Monocle app, available from the end of October via iTunes, is brought to you in association with Rolex.
Next up, it's a few of our favourite things with New York architect Deborah Burke.
Deborah Burke is one of America's most respected and successful architects, designers, and educators. A native New Yorker, Burke set up her practice in the city almost 30 years ago and is renowned for her delicate balance of minimalism and warmth. Burke and her family live on Manhattan's Upper East Side, just across the East River from the borough of Queens, where she grew up.
It's a glamorous
company.
Yeah, doesn't that look good?
I know, that's a beautiful
tea. My sour black tea. I love very that. Hard to find nice tea.
I'm Deborah Burke. I'm an architect based in New York. And we are in my apartment on Gracie Square, which is 84th Street, east of East End Avenue. It's way, way east. At the end of the block is the East River. And it is technically part of the Upper East Side. It's like suburban Manhattan up here. That's where I live. I live in suburban Manhattan.
Which is a rare thing to find.
Yes, exactly. A very rare thing to find. So we are standing in my kitchen, and unlike most New York City kitchens, it's a really big kitchen with a lot of counter space and a big stove. And on the island, which is where we're standing, right up against the edge of the island now, is one of my favorite things, and that is that the counter surface of my island is a piece of old bowling alley. And when I was designing this place, I was fondly remembering when I was in art school in Rhode Island in the 70s, and it was kind of a wild and crazy time. And bowling alleys were going out of business, and my sculpture world friends were making things out of bowling alleys. And as I was working on this apartment, I thought to myself, damn, I wonder if bowling alleys are still available. And it turns out that they continue to be in decline, maybe not in Manhattan, but in the rest of America. And they're essentially yours for the taking if you go and get them. So we found this guy in Brooklyn who is in the go get the bowling alley business, and I hired him to make me a countertop, which is what you're looking at. And what you can see here that I absolutely love about this thing is that bowling alleys are made out of two kinds of wood. This pale wood at the end where you see the long triangles that sort of tell you how to aim your ball. This is maple, and it's finger jointed in very long finger joints into fir, which is the sort of richer, darker, more honey-colored wood with the long, narrow grains. Fir is very soft and very cheap. So when they built bowling alleys, they put maple at the end where you dropped the ball and maple at the other end where the pins would fall down, and the whole middle was fir. So I particularly like this section of bowling alley because you see the two woods coming together. So,
and did you choose this section of
bowling? Absolutely. I needed to have the little triangles so that you could tell it was once a bowling alley. And I really loved seeing how the two kinds of woods were finger joined together, because it makes a really beautiful, rich, but still subtle pattern. And it speaks so nicely and so simply to the way things go together, which is something I'm fascinated by, something I think about every day.
And so looking over to the other side of the countertop, we have a Polaroid camera and a series of Polaroids. Tell us a little bit about why those are amongst your favorite things.
Well, the Polaroid is among my truly most favorite thing, and I have two of them. I have one here and one at my house on Long Island, and I use it to document dinner parties. So here's how it goes. So we have a scrapbook, and it's not really a scrapbook. It's a great old accountant's ledger, and when people come over, we take a picture of the party, the revelry, and we glue the picture in the book, and maybe we save the wine label. And if it was a big dinner party and I actually did a placement, I might even glue the little placement into the book so that there's kind
I
of
like
a memory.
That. That's wonderful.
And if somebody sleeps over, maybe they write in the book something about what the dinner was like. So the Polaroid, because it's such a cool, fabulous thing, and then because we use it to document really happy times, is on my list of, you know, objects that are dear to me. So we're going to walk from the kitchen into the dining room, which is another room I love, as you can see, because I like to entertain. And this is a Giuseppe Scapinelli dining table. And I love the kind of swoopy warmth of these very delicate wood legs. And I bought it because, if you notice, you know, to one side of our dining room is this big window looking out on our teeny backyard, but it is green and it is beautiful to look at. And on the other side is the living room, which is a couple of steps down. So when you're seated in the living room to look back at the garden, you're below the table. So you need to look through the table. So when I found this, and I found it in LA, it was aha. How perfect to look through those kind of sinuous, they're almost like 1940s forms, through them to the green of the garden.
And looking down so towards the living room area, if we can talk about your favorite things that are in the living room.
Okay.
And what makes up the living room and what we're walking into now.
So this is the only bit of color in this room, this bright pink original upholstery Bertoia diamond chair, which I have owned for almost 20 years. And I was alerted to the fact that an elderly architect had died in a tiny apartment in Manhattan, and his family didn't know what to do with his things, and they had no interest in his things, and would I be interested in buying them? And I went down to see them, and they were an unusual collection, not your typical sort of almost at this point they've become generic and uninteresting mid-century things, but some unusual. And this hot pink Bertoia chair, everybody knows the chair and its little ottoman, but as this bolt of color in this otherwise white and pale gray room, I love it. And it's really comfortable. And I'll sit here and read the Sunday Times. The dogs lie on the floor next to me. And I think I have a fondness for it, not only because I enjoy sitting in it and reading the paper with the dogs, but because I never knew the person it belonged to, but I feel a connection to him, and there are a few items of his scattered around my house. So this architect that I never knew shared a taste and a sensibility, and now his things live on in my house. So back in here, down the hall, and into my daughter's room, who is away at college, is really one of my most prized and most favorite possessions, and sometimes I just come in here to look at it. So this is a three-dimensional axonometric map of New York City drawn by a man named Herman Bullman in the 60s, as I understand it. I'm not a historian of maps, but as you can tell from this conversation, I love maps. I think that's something we share.
Yes.
And it is, so this was hand-drawn. This was long before, well long before the computer, and it basically looks at Manhattan from about 15th Street at the bottom of the rectangle. It's a rectangle that's approximately maybe 3.5 feet by 2.5 feet. And this was folded up, and it lived in my father's desk drawer. And my father has been gone for a decade now. I miss him. He was a consummate New Yorker, and he loved walking the streets, and he knew what corners, what buildings were on, and how those were changing. And so I got this framed, and you can still see the folds and the lines and the scotch tape where he held it together. So it goes, as I was saying, I'm sorry, all the way from 14th Street well up into Central Park, and every single building is meticulously drawn. I mean, it's crazy, every window. So here we are in the lower right-hand corner looking at the UN and the East River, and you get just the tip of Roosevelt Island, but of course where they're now building the FDR for Freedoms Park is still drawn as the old hospital that was there.
Gosh, it's incredible.
And one of the things I love about this, of course, is that it has all the high-rises of Midtown, and it has the Pan Am building, and it has the CBS building. So that great moment of kind of American enthusiasm is captured here, but also has the old Penn Station is still in this drawing. So a funny moment where some of those old buildings that were inefficient and broad but not tall are in this drawing, as well as this sort of new dynamic of the high rises. I love this map. I love what it captured. I love the active East River harbor on the top of the drawing, with boats pulling into piers. It feels like the vibrant city that New York is today, the city that I love, but it has the memory of many things that are gone.
That was Aisha Spears, our wonderful New York correspondent at the home of Deborah Burke in Manhattan. You're listening to Section D here on Monocle 24. We'll be back in a moment. I just love them. She has such a fantastic way of describing the emotional attachment to objects, which is exactly what we wanted from the piece.
No, I think she's one of those rare architects who revels in life and creates architecture that is a frame for that. I mean, she talks about how she loves to make buildings that are for sort of drinking and eating and sex and conversation and all the things that people do. And, you know, as straightforward as that might sound, it's extremely rare to hear an architect talking that way.
Exactly. It's very, very refreshing. And you can tell from the way that she talks about all the different elements in her house that she really has such a great sort of sensibility of material and atmosphere and the emotional quality that objects can have. I love how she describes the previous owner's attachment to the Bertoia chair and how she never knew him, but she can feel his appreciation of it when she sits in it. I think that's extraordinary. I also really want to go to one of her dinner parties. I want to get my Polaroid.
Yeah, but hair and makeup first, I think.
Have you ever met Deborah?
Never, but actually, you know, reading about her, I'd love to. She sounds absolutely great.
She is. I think she's wonderful. I mean, as you say, she's an architect that builds buildings for people to live in. And in fact, there's the first fair devoted to interior design coming up that I think you've got something to do with.
Yeah, no, I'm interested to see how that pans out. I've got
it's called Inside, is
yes,
that right?
Which is a good, it's a good new word, I think, because interiors has that, you know, objectifying thing that somehow reduces our lives to a series of tables and chairs. Whereas, you know, actually, of course, it's the space where we live, where, you know, 95% of our activities take place. So the idea that it's, you know, reduced to a spec list is kind of horrific. I mean, you know, interiors, inside, is about making the frame for life that Deborah was referring to. It's understanding what kind of activities will happen in that space and creating a support for that that can evolve and can amplify and accentuate those activities that can make them more functional on the one hand, but also more poetic on the other.
And Inside is attached to the World Architecture Festival, is it? In
yes.
Barcelona in a couple of weeks.
Which, of course, is the bit that I think is going to be really fascinating, because architects and interior designers do have a slightly uncomfortable relationship. It can be a great relationship.
Throwing
bricks. But I think there's a certain amount of sort of, mutual suspicion, I would say.
Okay. Well, we're going to be doing a report on that, actually, so I look forward to it. Up next is the first in our weekly series of design dispatches.
In a megalopolis like London, there's a lot to say about the built environment. You can find pretty much anything you want here, from medieval remains to the most contemporary landmarks, both loved and loathed. Designers and architects, great and small works side by side, camping out in ramshackle warehouses or sitting pretty in steel and glass blocks. Arguably, there's more happening here at the moment than ever before. To talk us through what's happening, I visited Sarah Ichioka, director of the Architecture Foundation, on the rooftop of her South London HQ in Bermondsey.
My name is Sarah Ichioka, and I'm director of the Architecture Foundation. London's such a cumulative city. I think that's really important to note. It's never been a particularly planned city. There have been the works of a few visionary developers or politicians here and there, but it's never, you know, unlike a city like Paris, for example. And there's never been a one uniform plan that's been carried out throughout. And I think it's interesting to see projects like the Shard here at London Bridge or the Olympic site, the Lehigh Valley, that will, in their own way, contribute to that patchwork. But it's not about imposing a greater order on things, which seems very true to the organic nature of London's fabric. We love being in this area because it's such a, as you said, such a diverse mix of things. And London, like so many great cities, grew up around this amazing body of water, the Thames River, which we can see right from our rooftop and our front door. Right across from us is the Tower of London, one of London's most historic buildings. We are almost directly opposite the original foundations of London. We're very close to the City of London, this ancient seat of power and trade and commerce around which the city was founded. We're kind of the area of Southwark where we're based used to be the beyond the walls area where a lot of the illicit, illegal, dangerous and fun things like theater used to happen. And it's interesting in the last, say, 10 years how it's really reoriented itself as a cultural center where you see a lot of former industrial buildings reappropriated for culture. For example, the best-known example, Tate Modern, it's about a 10-minute walk from here, taking over an old power station. It's hard to be here and miss the fact that we're directly opposite a very large new kind of grade A office development, and we're near City Hall, which is designed by Norman Foster, and then also the big brother on the skyline, the shard of glass tower, which is designed by Renzo Piano for Cellar Properties, which will be Western Europe's tallest building. I think that the tallest building crown always has to be more and more refined. I live in East London, and it's been so evident in the last 5 years, the scale of improvements, particularly to infrastructure, that have gone on, that I think Olympics, like them or not, wouldn't have happened without London securing the bid. So things like the East London Line, which connects all the way down to Croydon and Crystal Palace, and goes up through amazing places like Wapping and Whitechapel and up to us in Dalston, are really incredible new veins or new arteries within the city, and you can see a lot of projects happening around those. Equally with the recovery of the Lee Valley, which was formerly heavily industrial, a lot of really contaminated land, which will now be brought back into active use for redevelopment post-games. I think that'll be a really positive legacy too. I think one of the interesting things about the Olympic site is how all the juxtaposition of these fantastic buildings right next to each other. So the Orbit would be this spectacular thing in itself, but it's right next to Zaha Hadid's Aquatic Center, which is this incredible feat of design and engineering. It's gorgeous. And the two are slightly jostling for attention. You get that repeated across the Olympic site.
London's a tough, sprawling, chaotic city. And much like the people who live here, the buildings fight to be heard too. You only need to go up a few floors above ground level to see the messy diversity of architecture, old and new, jostling for attention. And this is its charm. Where else in the world do you see medieval ramparts next to skyscrapers, factories next to churches? Despite the chaos, it's a city that wears its rich history on its sleeve, and it tells a story through its architecture, past, present and future.
That was our very own Katie Bilboa on the streets of London.
Summing up London is not an easy task when it comes to design and architecture. I think both of them actually pick up on some interesting points about this continued entrepreneurial spirit that London is very good at fostering.
Yeah, there's something sort of bizarrely sort of Hogarthian about it. I mean, London's a sort of muscular, messy kind of livable megalopolis. I can never say that word properly. But, you know, it is filled with radicals who then become the sort of establishment. You know, it's a constantly changing, dynamic city. And, you know, there's many great things that come out of it. Fashion, music, the individualistic designer. I mean, you know, the thing about Britain, I think, that I find still quite problematic is that design is seen as a cultural thing.
Absolutely.
Whereas, you know, it's an economic thing, it's a social thing. You know, our whole world is designed, you know, well or not so well. Whereas I think our education system historically has sort of, you know, separated those who do money from those who are so-called creatives at birth, or more or less. I mean, I sort of, you know, 10 or 11, they're not allowed to speak to each other anymore and they don't speak the same language.
Mm-hmm. So if you had to choose between London and Eindhoven for the rest of your life, which would it be?
Well, I don't choose, do I? I have it both ways. I go between the two because undoubtedly living in a city like London is exciting. I love London. I live here. I have my studio here. But I think that today with cultural exchange, I think it's interesting to learn from places like Holland and, you know, to look at the pragmatic approach to design that I think they have.
Well, thank you very much, Ilse, for coming in and joining us. I've loved having you on my first show, and I hope that you'll come back again. On next week's show, we take a look at the luxury retail market, visiting a new blueprint for the department store in Milan, and chat to retail architect Peter Marino. I'll be joined in the studio by Penny Martin, editor of The Gentlewoman. But that's all for this week. This show was produced by Dawn Trump. I'm Hugo MacDonald.
And I'm Ilse Crawford.